we're going to get started in just a few minutes. I was just hoping for a few more folks to join. Okay. Also, as a reminder, I'll post the web page. I will have a recording of today's webinar, both the audio and the live recording on our web page, and I'll post the web page in a minute in the chat box for you. Feel free to take advantage of that if you want, or send it along. I don't want to cut John short on time, so I will get started here. We are lucky enough today to have Dr. Hintz from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst with us again today. The focus of today's webinar is implementing an RTI model. We will also have one more session before the break, and that is next Monday, December 16th at 4 p.m., and the topic is progress monitoring within an RTI framework. Registration information is on our webpage as well, and I'll put the webpage in the chat in a minute. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Dr. Hintz. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Molly, I assume you can hear me. I see my number still under participants, so I don't know if you send me a quick message to make sure that you can hear me.
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Oh, okay, because I see my number still. Okay,
if anybody else
good.
Is having trouble hearing, please post in the chat. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mark. Molly. And good afternoon, everyone. I see we have some people coming in, a little bit smaller group than last week if you are here. As Molly noted, my name is John Hintz, and I'm currently a professor and the director of the School Psychology Program at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And I've been involved with RTI in a number of different respects, beginning some years ago in the original curriculum-based measurement work that was done, particularly in the area of reading. And then since the passage of PL 941, now I'm dating myself, the reauthorization of IDEIA in 2004, I've been more involved in the RTI effort through my work in CBM. As the first slide indicates there, for a number of years, I was part of a working group. It was a federally funded center through the U.S. Department of Education. It was the National Center on Response and Intervention. You can see our website down there, www.rti4success.org. As I had mentioned last week, that center is no longer in existence. It was a five-year center, and our funding went away after 5 years. We're currently the National Center for Intensive Interventions. It's mostly the same folks. You can access their website. And I'll make some references to some of the tools that are available up on that website today. But their website is, and I'll put it in right down here, www.intensiveinterventions.org. Let me just check on that if it's intensive interventions or, oh, good thing I checked, intervention.org. And you can see a lot of the stuff, some of the stuff I'll be referencing there today, particularly I think what would be of most use is our tools chart for selecting the different kinds of tools for use in RTI. The focus of today's, last week I gave kind of, for those who were here last week, a kind of a broad overview of RTI, how assessment fits into RTI, kind of a historic background or maybe some rationale as to why we think RTI makes sense from an alternative assessment paradigm, its linkages to prevention and public health model, which we'll review today briefly. But today I'd like to talk a little bit about universal screening within an RTI model and how we can choose assessments, what we can expect those assessments or should expect those assessments to be able to do, and how they fit into an overall RTI model. As Molly said, there's a chat window or a question window. If you want to type questions as we're moving along, I can try to keep an eye on them and then get to them as I think that they're relevant within the presentation. Last week, I used a a quick illustration for what I think RCI, a good way to think about RCI, and I'll use it again today for those of you who have seen it. Bear with me for just a moment. But if someone were to ask you later on today, or you know, bump into someone and say, well, what is this RTI stuff all about? How does it, you know, describe it to me in a way that makes sense? I think probably one of the best ways that I know that I've seen that most people have some types of experience with are height and weight charts or growth charts that we see with our pediatricians. And as I said last week, we don't see these oftentimes too much anymore, like in a file, but usually they're on their laptop or their tablet or whatever they're keeping tabs of your child's growth and development over. But what I think is interesting about this chart is that essentially the pediatrician uses it much in the same way that we would use RTI measures in our assessment process. And this graph right here is for a girl. You can see on the top, happens to be a white girl. They have different ones, obviously, by sex and then ethnicity. And you can see that we can start to kind of assess it, a young girl's height at about age 2. You can see on the far left. I'm never quite sure if you can see my cursor. I don't think you can. But and then all the way up to about the age of 17. You see also that about the ages of 11 and 12, it starts to taper off. What the red lines represent is the different growth rates. So the bottom red line represents the 5th percentile, the top red line, the 95th percentile, and the heavier one down the middle is the 50th percentile. And on the right-hand column, you can see it would be a young girl's height in inches or in centimeters. And what I think is interesting about this chart is that essentially what we're doing in RTI screening is getting a dynamic snapshot of a child's growth over time. And I say that what I mean by dynamic is that it's not static and it changes over time. This little girl that I just put up there is one of my daughters from a number of years ago. I always like that picture over there. But this, and her name is Tori, Victoria, or Icky Vicky, depending on the day. Today she was Tori. She didn't, not too much Icky Vicky's come out yet. But this is, as you can see, with her her height estimate at age 2, and you can see that she's not quite at the 5th percentile, but she's a little bit higher. She's usually around the 10th percentile or so. And you can see this was her measurement at age 3, and then kind of another one at age 4, and 5, and 6, and 7, and so on and so forth. And if I was to peek in the pediatrician's folder, I would see something that looked like this. Now, what's interesting about this this illustration is that two things. One is her percentiles remain relatively the same. She's probably somewhere around the 12th to 15th percentile, somewhere around there, or hovering around the 10th. So she was the 10th. And if I was to just look at her record over time in percentiles, I would see that she was consistently right at that 10th to 12th percentile, somewhere around there. Now, if that was a summative assessment and that was the only piece of information that we had, and let's kind of turn the tables quickly and turn it into an academic system, if the only thing I saw was 10th percentiles in reading or math consistently from year to year, over, in this case, it looks like about an 8 or 9 year period, I would probably be pretty concerned about her, right? But what's interesting when we think about assessment data from a dynamic perspective and just not a static perspective like we would do percentiles, is if we look at the raw data across years, we actually see that she's growing, right? She's growing commensurate with children who are at her about the 10th percentile. She's also commensurate with the growth of children who are at about the 25th, the 50th, the 75th, and the 95th percentile. And this is one of the interesting things, I think, about this type of assessment system. If we look collectively across those yellow lines, their slope of growth, if you will, is pretty consistent. You know, it's not until about, oh, it looks like it's about maybe age 7 or 8 that the lines start to diverge a little bit. And of course, the girls at the 95th percentile start growing at a little faster rate, and the girls at the 5th percentile a little bit slower rate. But by and large, for a good many years of the developmental course, those children are growing at the same rate. are a similar rate. It's just that they happen to start at different points. And this is essentially what RTI screening data is going to allow, should allow us to do. So let me say, should allow us to do. Any assessments that we have should be able to provide us with summative information, that is, kinds of things that we're used to, minimally percentiles, maybe standard scores, things like that. But their raw scores should be interpretable as well. That is, that the measures, the scores that we see over time should have some meaning to us so that we should be able to use those with some other measures. So, for example, we'll talk next week about progress monitoring measures to make the kinds of decisions that we need to make in an RTI model. You might be saying, well, that's all well and good for the physicians or pediatricians, but what would that look like then in RTI academically? Well, this is just one example here, and certainly there are other ones. Good assessments, good RTI screening assessments will have those kinds of features. And this one happens to come from Ames Web. It's kind of, I clicked it some years ago or a while ago. So while the numbers in terms of that are correspond to the percentiles are roughly the same, what's a little bit different is the cell sizes. That means the sample sizes. Like if I look across the top line under the spring, that 89,000 is probably quadruple or maybe five times that number right now. But what this chart illustrates for us then are some of those same principles as this chart. So if I looked across, you can see grade, and we see grade on the left-hand column, and then we see across the top fall, winter, and spring. I can see that during the fall of any given year in any given grade, I should be able to approximate what children at roughly those red, what corresponds to those red lines on the previous graph showed. So, for example, if I look at third grade students, I could tell you that average third graders, which would be represented by the 50th percentile, would be reading about, somewhere around, that got shifted down a little bit, around 78 words correct per minute. If I move back, let me do it this way. If I followed those same third graders up to the winter, you would say that while they're still at the 50th percentile, they've now reading about 98 words correct per minute. So we see about a growth of about 20 words correct per minute in between those two benchmark assessments. Typically, the benchmark assessments are separated by about 9 or 10 weeks, which would be roughly about, 2 words correct per minute per week growth. And then if I move them up here as well, you can see that those same students in the spring are now reading about 112 words correct per minute, and for a growth, again, of about 14 words correct per minute. The other thing, too, is if you can see, if I move this backwards, as you can see that there's a steady increase as I move up the percentile. So students in third grade who are at the 10th percentile are reading about 30 words correct per minute. Students at the 25th, about 50 words correct per minute. And then you can see as we move on up, 78 words correct per minute, 105, and 133. Another thing that I think is interesting, too, if we look at those 10th percentile students, and if we move from the fall where they're reading 30 words correct per minute to the spring, the winter where it's 42 correct words correct per minute, that represents a growth of about 12 words correct per minute between those two baseline assessments, whereas we had just looked and we saw that the 50th percentile students or average students grow about 20 words correct per minute. You can see that the difference between the 20 words correct per minute and the 12 words correct per minute is fairly sizable at this rate. And even if we moved up further, we would see that kind of discrepancy is still there. It moves to 11 words correct per minute, where the 50th percentile students are reading about, or increasing about 14 words correct per minute. And that really, I think, is a good example of what Keith Standovich was talking about when he referenced the Matthew effect in reading, and that is borrowed from the biblical passages that the rich get richer and the poorer get poorer. In this case, as the students who are struggling continue to struggle throughout their years and as they move through the grades, while those students who are doing well or even exceeding are growing at an exceeding rate, and that gap gets bigger and bigger. And as you can see, it occurs very early on in a child. If we look up and down this chart, it occurs very early on in a child's development And this is one of the reasons we spoke last week. If students first come to our attention when they're between the ages or grades of third and fourth, and that's the first time we try to intervene with them because, perhaps another model like a discrepancy model, it's the first time we're kind of allowed to do that. It's at a point where that gap has been growing now for a couple of years, and unfortunately it's somewhat hard to retract at that time. So we do have good assessment screening measures that should have these kinds of features then that are similar to this growth model. The other thing too, as I think is noticeable here and it's noteworthy, is that in this notion of what I talked about dynamic before, the data points are consistently going up, even though the student's staying at the same percentile rank. Right. If I look back at Tori here, she's still at around that 10th to 12th percentile, even though her data are moving up. And the same, if we eyeballed these, would be happening on a graph like this. And someone once said to me, they said, well, this really doesn't seem fair. It's like, it seems like we're trying to hit a moving target. And in fact, that's the challenge with students who are struggling, is that while we're intervening, we're doing our best to get them back on track, their peers aren't standing still. They're moving as well, and oftentimes moving or growing at a rate that exceeds the current growth rates of students who are struggling. So the challenge with RTI then is developing intensive interventions that not only get them back on a growth rate or trajectory that's similar to their average peers, but one that exceeds the growth rates of their average peers, because it's only at that point in time that we can we start to see that gap close, or what sometimes we call catch up. This also too on this chart, if I were to look on the far right hand column, you see a column there called labeled ROI, and that stands for rate of improvement, and that's sometimes what people refer to as slope as well. So if I was to look at, you know, on first grade, I can see that average first graders at the 50th percentile, on average across the whole year, it's aggregated across the whole year now, grow a little bit more than a word a week, about 1.2 words correct per minute per week. Then we can see on up and down that line that typically students will grow at about 1 to 2 words or 1.5 words growth per week. So the challenge, as I noted before in an RTI model, is to exceed those growth rates to get children back on track. So hopefully this helps us maybe illustrates a little bit more what we're trying to do in an RTI model. Essentially, an RTI model is going to, our screening model is going to allow us to do two things then. Measure students' growth at various times during the year, which we can see here, measure it in a way that the raw score units, or in this case, the number of words read correctly per minute, or it could be the numbers of problems solved, or the number of letters correct sequences in the spelling test, have meaning in the sense that they're on a continuous scale and they continue to grow over the year. And that secondly is that those raw score units can be also translated to percentile ranks so that we can make judgments about how much a child has grown from one time period to another relative to their peer group, okay? Relative to their peer group. So a screening assessment should say, if I saw a child, again, a 50th percentile child in third grade, and they moved from, let me go to the next here, and they were an average child, and they were a dead solid average, and in the fall they read 78 words correct per minute, in the winter 98 words correct per minute, and it was an individual child, I say, wow, that child grew, irrespective of their peers, about 20 words correct per minute, and that I could see in raw score units, I could graph that, we'll do that, those kinds of things next week on the progress monitoring, and I could see how that growth evidenced itself for an individual student. If I, though, was then to, so an answer to a question is, has this child grown in response to the intervention? In this case, the intervention might be the tier one core curriculum. I could say pretty solidly, yes, they've grown, and they've grown at a rate that is typical of peers at their level. If I asked another question and said, well, have they improved their reading skills relative to their peers, meaning have their growth and development improved above and beyond the typical growth rate of their peers, I'd probably answer that no, because they're still at the 75th percentile. If on the other hand, I saw a child in the spring, in the fall, go from 55 to the winter of 106, which would represent a movement from the 50th to the 75th percentile, then I'd be able to say, yes, not only have they almost doubled their reading skills in terms of the words read correct per minute, but they've also made considerable growth relative to their peer or normative group, and that in the sense of that they've gained 25 percentile points in this case. So the point here is that good screening assessments, ones that are relevant for RTI, should be able to do those two things for us. They should be able to provide us with raw scores that make sense for an individual child that we can interpret relative to an individual child's growth from one point to another. And then secondly, we should be able to use them to, say, make determinations as to whether or not they have gained with respect to their peer group. And perhaps the example I just used was a poor one, 50th to the 75th percentile. And let me change it quickly and say, in this case, we have a child who is at the 10th percentile in the fall, and then with represented by a score of 30 words correct per minute, and that in the winter they read 98 words correct per minute. Well, in answer to that first question, I'd say again, wow, they almost tripled their oral reading fluency rate, right? They moved from 30 to 98, which would be a difference of 68 words correct per minute, which would be 6.5 words correct, a gain of about 6.5 or in excess of 6 words correct per minute per week. But I'd also be able to say now, here's a child who went from about the 10th percentile to the 50th percentile, although that's unlikely. By way of example here, I'd be able to say, here's a child who moved from the bottom of the score distribution to the middle of the score distribution. If this was a child who was in tier 2 intervention, then I would probably say, well, here's a child who is now probably we can start to wean back on the tier 2 intervention and consider just the tier 1 intervention. So anyway, these two charts here, I think, give a good example of what we're trying to do in RTI screening assessment, is that we're trying to, again, have choose measures. Screening measures allow us to interpret scores, raw scores, for an individual child, irrespective of their peers. And then secondly, can be transformed into the types of standard scores, namely percentiles that we can use for making relative decisions about how a child stacks up to their peers. I just flip back here because I also want you to know is that for AIMSWeb users, you should also know is that for any grade level, this chart just has the 90th, 75th, 50th, 25th, and 10th percentile, is at any grade level, you can go back into the normative table and get the full spectrum of percentile ranks all the way from the first up to the 99th, and it will give you the oral reading fluency scores that are associated with each one of those. So for those districts that I've worked with, and even when I've used AIMSWeb in training or with my students, I always like to have those charts printed out and available to me, because then I can have a little bit more precise account of growth from one benchmarking period to the next. We talked last week about what does an overall RTI model look like and how does screening fit in there, and we'll go back to that in a moment. Last week we had talked about in New York State is that you have a three-tier model with special education as being separate, not a separate tier, but separate. What I would suggest is that there's probably two ways of then using RTI screening data or benchmark assessment data for making decisions. We can use either the universal benchmarks themselves that should come with each screening assessment, or the ones that you pick, or a combination of universal benchmarks plus brief progress monitoring. I'll explain what those look like here in just a little bit. I'm going to use AIMSWeb as my primary example, because most in my experience, most people are using either AIMSWeb or Dibbles, and nowadays more and more users are using AIMSWeb because of the math, spelling, and written language, and also behavioral component that goes along with it. We talked about using commercially available manualized interventions for Tier 2. What this means is that they're not individually derived through some problem-solving method, that there's kind of a one-size-fits-all. We talked a little bit last week why I suspect that those things work, probably due to increased opportunities to respond and because they're highlighting those core areas that a lot of students have problems with. Students in Tier 3 then go into problem solving. That's where we do a little bit more individualized interventions. We talked last week about that some of those things actually might look like the interventions or, let me say, instructional strategies that go on in special education. We talked about direct instruction, little d, little or lowercase d, lowercase I. And as we'll talk next week, we define response to intervention, or in answer to the question, has the intervention worked? Well, we use a combination of slope, or growth over time, and then final status using universal benchmarks. We'll talk about that next week. And then under responders, then they go through a comprehensive evaluation to determine the need for special educational services. Where we left off last week, too, as well, is that we left off with this kind of circular, three circles here, is that any good RTI assessment model should probably have three things going on at one time. We need assessment systems, we need periodic universal screening, we need frequent continuous progress monitoring. As I noted last week, it's very helpful if the universal screening and progress monitoring measures come from the same suite of measures. So examples of those would be AIMS-Web and DIBELS, just to name two. There are others, though. If you use one measure for screening and then another for progress monitoring, as we'll see next week for those of you who come back next week, is when we come to answer the question, has the intervention worked? Well, it's hard to tell because we're comparing apples and oranges. We're comparing one universal benchmark screening assessment and then trying to make sense of it with a second different progress monitoring assessment, which is just difficult to do. We also need to have instructional systems. We need to have a scientifically based core curriculum. We need to have thought ahead of time about what our different interventions will look like or could look like in Tier 2 and Tier 3. Without those, particularly for those this time of year, this is a little late in the year, but after the fall benchmark, and if they haven't given a lot of thought to this, all of a sudden you have a lot of a handful of children or more that are yellow, typically in your color-coded reports, and now if you haven't given some thought ahead of time, you don't know what to do with them, so it's good to have that up and going ahead of time. And then lastly, we need methods of organizing the data and then a playbook, if you will, for making decisions on the data. Probably fewer folks now need methods of organizing data. Most, we have a lot of computer applications to this, but I can remember as near as 3 or 4 years ago starting to work with districts that hadn't given much thought to this, perhaps maybe downloaded the free DIBELS that are still available or some other types of benchmark assessments and hadn't given thought to how are they going to organize the data to make sense of it. One school I remember in the western part of Massachusetts just had everything in notebooks and just kind of organized the actual probes themselves by grade. So we simply used an Excel spreadsheet to kind of with some macros in there to color code students that have, depending on the score, they would get automatically color coded red, yellow, or green. And then lastly is that playbook for making decisions. How do we know who our students are going to be who are at risk? How do we know when we've made how do we know when our interventions have led to the kinds of increases that we'd like to see and the like? We talked about RTI as being a multi-tiered prevention system coming from a public health model. It's based on these notions of primary prevention, secondary prevention, tertiary prevention. Primary prevention being those kinds of things that we use for all children in hopes of staving off new incidences of the problem. So good core curriculum can do that for us. And we'll see some examples a little bit later on of this. Secondary prevention is kind of like our Tier 2 guys. And tertiary prevention is oftentimes probably more like what we think about in special education here. When we put that all together, this is where we finished off last week, we have a triangle that oftentimes the data are put into. And this is this triangle is based on some of the work many years ago by Ed Kamehanui at University of Oregon and colleagues. Some of the work they were doing in Oregon and California, and what they had found is that in good instructional environments, we can expect that the core curriculum, or should expect that the core curriculum, meets the learning needs of about 80% of the students with no additional support or intervention. We should probably expect then about 20% of our students that the core curriculum is not meeting their learning needs learning needs. About 15% of those, that 20, the core curriculum plus some supplemental intervention is likely enough to get them back on track, or we should expect at any point in time about 15% of students to need more than just the core curriculum. And that would be in addition to the core curriculum, something supplemental. And then about 5 to maybe 7%, depending on which studies you look at, are those students who really require probably substantial and different types of instruction to meet their learning needs. Oftentimes, these children might look at, might be the students in special education. I had mentioned last week, in a four-tier model, one that we train in at the university, the special ed would be a top, and then in between the red and the yellow would be an orange, and that would be our tier three guys. And there's actually a fairly small percentage of folks, because what we've found in our research and evaluation of RCI efforts is about when we catch them at the right time, and that's the key, catching them at the right time, we should expect to be successful with about 3 out of 4, 75% of our tier two children in getting them back into tier one intervention and not hearing from them for some time. That leaves about 1 out of 4 that goes into tier three. Actually, we've found probably there's a good deal of those, a certain percentage of those, particularly in the area of reading, that might end up in special education. We've had more success in the area of math with tier three intervention. So that kind of provides a schematic for us, or at least some of our targets for our screening efforts. And we'll see this triangle represented in different forms in a little bit here. I'm just trying to organize I got my slides going on a separate computer too here too as well. So what are the basics of RCI, just as an organizer here? Well, if I were to go back to those three concentric circles, assessment, intervention, and decision making, you should see each one of those circles, or you should expect to see that at each tier of the RCI model is that there is something from each one of those circles operating at any one point in time. So for tier one, the instructional system is the scientifically validated core. All right, I know this is today is geared towards screening, but screening is hard to talk about screening in the absence of what the instructional system is. We'll see some example here in a little bit. Is that basically what the screening system is? I know oftentimes people think of it as evaluating the students. Okay, and I guess in some sense it is. Their growth over time, or their growth at any one point in time, and then if we measure them sequentially, like in a benchmark assessment, then we can see them over time. But it's also, in some ways, I believe, evaluating the core curriculum and its ability to meet the learning needs of those students within your system. Okay, and I know that's a slightly different way of thinking about it. So, for example, if we saw, and we'll see some examples later here, some data, aggregated data from screening, where we saw substantially less red or green than we typically expect, well, one answer to that could be is that, well, it's the students in our system. There's some that come to us as not having maybe some of the prerequisites. They have other types of risk factors in their profiles that are leading to their challenges with literacy, and that's why we're seeing less green than expected. And I can understand that. But another hypothesis would be is that for those students, given who they are and their risk factors, the core curriculum that's been chosen doesn't interact well with them. Okay, so or it interacts in a way that doesn't bring about maximal benefit. So I'll use an example of my own children in the school that they go to. Here, I live in Connecticut, although I work in Massachusetts. They use a guided reading approach, all right, leveled-based guided reading approach. They don't have basals and the like. And it works for them. It works for students in their schools. We're not given the CMTs this year. We're moving toward the new state assessment. But by and large, when you look at their district data, they're doing very, very well. And that's because that reading approach is probably well matched to the children in the town in which I live. That is, most of the students, as far as I can tell, come to kindergarten and first grade knowing that have broken the alphabet, understand or broken the alphabetic code And understand those little squiggly things have sound with them, and that actually you can put a bunch of them together to make different sounds, and that the sounds put together can make words. And they come to kindergarten probably with a fairly robust sight word vocabulary. Okay, and when you have that as your sample or as your population within your district, the approach that they use works really well. Contrast that then to a perhaps a school district or a town. We work, this is oftentimes the ones that we're asked to come in and work with at the university or through the center, that have more risk factors than children in the town that I live. They come to school having not broken the code, not perhaps not understanding that those little squiggly things, letters, have sounds associated with them and the like. If we were then to choose a real an approach like they use in my town, it might interact with those students differently, so that we would see lower scores. And in fact, then if that was the case and I saw that in the data and I had unlimited resources, paint my blue sky, I might say, well, let's bring in a core reading curriculum that was a little bit more skills emphasized, since this is what these children appear to need. Try it and then evaluate it over time. And that's one of the added bonuses, I think, of RTI screening assessment, is that not only does it paint a picture for students at different times of the year, but if we look at it over a series of years, it in essence can be an evaluation of the kinds of curricular approaches and instructional approaches that we've chosen to use with the students that we have. So it really does a number of different things for us at one time and over time. Under the assessment, you can see here that all students are periodically screened using universal assessment procedures. Those students who, and then there's some decision-making system here. And actually at the screening level, the decision-making is pretty simple. It can be as simple as those students who fall below the benchmark screening, whatever score that is, would be considered to be in need of Tier 2 intervention, right? Now, the trick here is in deciding what that cut score is. Most assessments now in an RTI model that are commercially available will provide you at least some insight into what maybe some of those cut scores can be. So, for example, in Ames Web, you can use the default ones if you'd like. You can use ones that are derived from your district. You can use ones that have been aggregated nationally, or you can override the whole system and put your own ones in, right? So there's a number of different ways. The only thing I would do is caution you is that you should choose ones that make sense based on your school district, okay? So, for example, if I was to use AmesWeb again here, is that if you were in a district, and this happens more frequently than you'd expect, because someone has to set up the system or make some choice at some point in time about which cut scores to use. And if they don't know, they might choose the wrong one. So, for example, if you work in a district where your kind of aggregated profile of reading or math or whatever it is that you're dealing with is lower than state or national averages, and if you use the local, the benchmarks that are derived from your local sample, meaning the students in your district, you'll probably have, when you see your data, you probably say, wow, we have a lot more green and fewer yellows than what we thought we had, okay? And that would be the case because it's comparing individual student data to the local data. And in that case, you would be correct. You would say, wow, that we have a lot more green. If, though, you toggled between those boxes and now just hit the switch or toggled the box that said, the national data norm, you would see, you might see a whole bunch of children who were previously green, which would typically indicate not in need of Tier 2 intervention, all of a sudden turn yellow, right? Now they need Tier 2 intervention. Well, what's happened there? Well, what's happened is that the national norm is likely higher than any local norm, and there's probably a bunch of students who, while locally, look like they're well within the average range. When you compare them to a national norm, they probably look like they need some assistance. So for districts who are in that kind of situation, I would always suggest using a more national norm, because not that the national norm is better, but if the goal of the RCI process is to identify as many students as possible who need extra support, the choosing of the higher norm will yield you more yellow and then be able for you to get at those students and see whether or not they respond to the intervention. The flip side could occur, though, for districts that whose norms typically exceed a national profile. And I remember actually being in Buffalo, so this is going probably some years back, probably 8 or 9 years ago. I forget, it was a large workshop, and one of the districts said, but we have so little, the assessment system is not working for us. It yields so little yellow and so little red that it's not identifying. We know we have students, right, that need some support. All norm groups are local, right? And this happened to be a district then who is exceeding the national norms. In those cases, what I would say is use the local norms then, because then it will create that, if you want, that yellow or those tier two students, a pool of tier two students that you can begin to intervene on. Okay, so the choice of the norm group is the benchmark is an important one here. And then of course in Ames Web you can override the whole system, and if you follow your data over time, and you know kind of have a good sense of where your tier two students are or where they typically are with respect to reading scores and math scores, you can always go in then and set what those benchmarks would be. And then that, again, the data that you'll get configured will be based on those benchmarks that you set. You might want to do that in situations where you know you have a finite number of resources to provide tier two intervention. Now, I know that's probably kind of silly because everyone's dealing in a finite system. But if you got pretty facile with the data and you knew, for example, how many students you were likely to get in need of tier two intervention based on a certain cut score, then you could go in and put those own scores in yourself. And in essence, I think probably this is what a lot of people do when they use multiple screening assessments. They somehow kind of look at it all in a collective and then make some decisions as to what the cut scores on different things would be. So I hope that wasn't confusing, but the point is that depending then on what cut score, the cut score that you choose will yield to different will yield you different pools of students. And that's in the instance where you're just going to use the benchmark. A second way to do it, as Ann mentioned earlier, is to use both a benchmark as a first cut, then also progress monitor students for a short amount of time to confirm or disconfirm that risk status. Okay. Now this is something that we've trained in at through the center. There are not too many districts that I know of that do this, but I'll show you an example here in a moment. We may want to do this. The reason why we suggest doing this at times is that for those students who are just hovering around the cut score, right? And perhaps if the assessment had been a week or two later, the benchmark assessment that is a week or two later, and if they were growing about 2 words correct per minute per week, they might have grown 4 or 5 words, and that might have bumped them over the cut score, right? So what it helps in determining whether or not the timing of the benchmark assessment has anything to do with determining risk. So I'll show you how to do that as well. Okay, typically we do our screenings toward the end of September, early October for most districts that start right after Labor Day. So if we go back and use this chart, as you recall, typically what in most of those cut scores, the third approach that I didn't mention actually when I'm choosing cut scores before is to draw a line in the sand choosing a percentile rank. In this case, we've chosen here is the 25th percentile. And if we've chosen the 25th percentile, which is one that I'm very comfortable with as determining risk status, any child who scores at or below the 25th percentile would initially be considered at risk and in needing a tier two intervention. I've seen other models that have used the 16th percentile. That's typically someone who's using the normal curve, and 16th percentile would be below one standard deviation below the mean. The only the caution that I would provide on using the 16th versus the 25th or any percentile rank is, depending on what you use, you might find that there might be some false positives or false negatives. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, let's say in the case of third grade, as I'm looking at these data, I have a child who's reading, let me say 43 words correct per minute, and it's in the fall. Well, if I was using the 25th percentile, that student would be brought into intervention. He's below the 25th percentile with score 43, and we'd be bringing him into intervention. Now, if he was a student who really didn't need intervention, we would figure that out one of two ways. One way is if we monitored his growth, which I'll show you here in a moment, over a couple weeks, with or without the intervention, typically without. And if he grew and he hit the 50th or the 20, hit a score of 50, then we would know he was at the, probably it was the timing of the assessment that had to do with things. And that would be a happy surprise for us. We thought he needed help and he really didn't. If, however, he really did need help, and as long as we used the 25th percentile, all things would be fine. He would be brought into intervention. Where the danger could occur, or the risk is, I'd say, probably not danger, is that if we use the 16th percentile, and let's say that score of 43, that the score that corresponds to the 16th percentile was really like a score of 40, and if we use the 16th percentile with a score of 43, we'd say, no, he's not going to be brought into Tier 2. Now, if he was really someone who was the timing of the assessment, it wouldn't make, again, he would be fine. But if he was someone who really needed help and we didn't catch him because of our percentile rank, we would probably not catch him for another at least a year or so until he fell below that 16th percentile. And the risk with using a lower percentile is that in the cases where students, it might miss children who really need help, false positives in this case. And as time marches on, that gap grows bigger. And as I noted last week, depending on what grade that is, if that gap gets large enough, we might say, okay, finally we can get them into Tier 2 intervention. But it might be the time when the gap is so large that it might be hard to collapse or get him back on track. So by way of example here again, I tend to recommend using a higher percentile, probably nothing more than 25th, to get because those students who need help will certainly get it, and those who didn't need it because of the timing of the assessment or because their score was so near the cut score, they'll show us very quickly over time that they don't need the assessment or they don't really require that level of support. We can get them back into Tier 2. All right. So so as I said, one way is to just use a hard fast line in the sand, the 25th percentile or whatever that you set the defaults for in your system, and sticking with that. Another way to do it, as I noted before, is to take those students and monitor them for a short period of time. In this example here, this is a math example, a little girl named Anne, and we can see in the fall of a given year this is an old example. This is a number of digits correct. It would be problem solved now, but just for example sake, all we need is numbers and some ways to make decisions here. And Anne in the fall had a score of 5, and we could see that if we looked at this chart that her score of 5 would actually be really much more around the 10th percentile, okay? But if we were using a benchmark plus progress monitoring approach, we would monitor Anne's growth over a period of weeks. And in this case, this is 8 weeks. This would bring us all the way up to the next benchmark. But if we did it over 3 or 4 weeks, we could see that her slope of improvement is really actually pretty good, right? She's growing at about 1 digit correct per minute or 1 problem solved per minute here, and or for 3 minutes. And that if we compare that back to her previous chart, typical children, even at the 50th percentile, are only growing a third of a digit. Well, she's nearly triple that, okay? So what are we to conclude in the case of Anne? Well, it's likely that the timing of the assessment worked to her disadvantage, and she looked like she perhaps needed Tier 2, but she probably didn't, okay? Again, if we look at the rates of improvement over on the right-hand side, we'll see that she almost tripled the typical growth rates, right? That third of a digit corresponds to the 50th percentile. Hers, if I go back a moment ago, if I look, her slope was 1.00. Again, she's nearly tripled that. Anne's case now is that she's probably approximating now about 15 or 16 digits corrects per minute or more. The reason why I put an X to the fall is that we're probably now approaching the winter. And our probably conclusion with Anne would be, is keep an eye on her and to see if she catches up. And it appears that she did. So she would probably wouldn't be a student who we consider for tier two intervention in that case. Again, fewer districts do this, but if you have, if you're a district who, if you're worried that you're making a number of false positives based on your benchmark, you could progress monitor the student for a couple weeks. I'd certainly advocate this if you do your benchmarks early on. I know some districts do them in the first couple weeks of school. That could have a significant effect on the timing of their benchmark. So if you did that early September, rather than rushing everyone into tier two intervention, I might say is that since you're going to progress monitor them anyway, because they're in tier two intervention, progress monitor them weekly, and then probably toward the end of September, early October, take a look at their growth rates, and then make a second distinction as to whether or not, who are the children who haven't grown in the last 3 to 4 or 5 weeks, depending on when you benchmark them, and those that have and probably would have hit benchmark if we had a benchmark that was really more in line with a fall benchmark. Just as another example, here's another little boy named Arthur. Again, a number of different, progress monitored him more than we would need to, but you see just by way of an example here again that after 3 or 4 weeks, Arthur wasn't growing much. In fact, if we look at his slope of improvement, he was growing at 0.0 digits per week. He's kind of flatlined here. If we compare it as he continues on, he's going to, again, his slope is much lower than what we expect, as you can see on the ROI. We can see now he's moved from the fall to the winter. Arthur's not responding to the core curriculum and should probably move into tier two. Okay, so he would be an automatic. So again, to summarize real quickly here, in making screening decisions, you have one of two different ways to make those. You can use just a benchmark assessment, again, with the caution or some line in the sand, with the caution that depending on the way that you set, it's all important. What you set that line in the sand in as is going to then determine who is particularly green and yellow for the purposes of tier two assessment, and that children could change color on the basis of moving that benchmark around. Importantly, you want to choose a benchmark that makes sense for you. So if your district, again, is a little bit lower than the national profile, it probably makes sense to use kind of a national aggregate. If your district's doing better than average, you might be best used in using a more local profile. You could use simply the 25th percentile, using those numbers and filling those in, or using them overriding the defaults. The 25th percentile, I should say, would be the national aggregate, knowing that you're going to pick up as many those children who probably need additional support relative to a national sample. Or you could, if you're that facile with the numbers, you could override the whole system and put your own benchmarks in there that might represent the number of students that you'd be able to serve given your resources. So there's a number of different ways to do that. Okay. At the center, I just wanted to go through, I know while as I look kind of at the number of hits that the center gets on their tool charts, and just in terms of districts that I work with, Ames Web is probably one of the more popular ones. But if you were a district that wasn't using Ames Web, or really was in a position where you were trying to choose a screening assessment, the way that the center approached this early on was to evaluate screening instruments along a number of different psychometric properties. And you can see on the top here is that we define screening as that involved brief assessments that are reliable, valid, and evidence-based, that are conducted with all students or targeted groups of students who identify students who are at risk for academic failure and therefore likely to need additional or alternative forms of instruction to supplement the conventional general educational approach. I would also say is that for progress monitoring, they have to be at least evidence that we can give them at least monthly. So in the area of screening, it probably makes sense to make sure that whatever we choose has, we'll go through these psychometric properties, but common enough alternate forms that we can minimally give them at least 3 times a year. Okay, it's probably best practice to go fall, winter, and spring. Some of the behavior screeners that I've seen now yield, it's more typical to do kind of like a fall and then the spring and leaving out the winter. All right. What we do know is that students make considerable growth, and actually some data patterns are curvilinear, meaning that it's not quite a straight line from fall to winter, winter to spring, is that oftentimes children make more growth, and actually we saw that on the chart that we were showing, playing with before, is that they make more growth in the fall to winter than they do in the winter to spring. Not by much, too much, but it's enough that it warrants having that winter benchmark in there. So the center evaluated all screening instruments with respect to reliability, and we have different flavors of those, if you will. We have test, retest, alternate form, split half, and internal consistency, validity. And those of you who have taken the test and measurement course will recognize a lot of this, concurrent, predictive. A third way that the center evaluated screening instruments, and this is extremely important, is that with respect to what we call classification or diagnostic accuracy. And I don't expect that any this will be familiar to anyone, but these what we have under there are called sensitivity, specificity, positive predictive power, negative predictive power. You know, I can give you a quick example. Is that I remember many years ago when the DIBELS were first being kind of rolled out, and there's a lot of research going on. I went to a talk by Roland Good at one of the conferences I was at, and it was based on the original dissertation work that the DIBELS were derived from. And they had these 33 students that they tracked over time, and they said, "Well, you see, these 33 students, when we followed them, these guys." Turned into really good readers, and they kind of had that. They looked like spaghetti strands to me. And then these guys on the bottom, they struggled over a number of years. And they using those two approaches only are what we call sensitivity in the case of being those children who did well, and we predicted that with a high level of accuracy, and those students who didn't do well as being specificity. But there was a lot of spaghetti strands in the middle that were misclassifications, right? And this is kind of before we started to think about classification accuracy. But what this means is that your screening measures should be developed in a manner in which they're able to provide information that they, in fact, catch the true positives and the true negatives, the true positives being those students who really need further assistance, true negatives, those students who really don't need the help, and then at the same time minimize those false positives and false negatives that I mentioned before. That is, students that we think need help that really don't, or students that we think are okay that really need help. Okay, because if we don't focus on that, what we can do is we can play with the numbers and we can design a screening instrument that looks really, really good because it has a lot of true positives, but what it's missing is a lot of the false positives, right? So whatever you choose, you want to make sure that your screening instrument is able to do this for you, that it's sensitive, basically, to determining or showing those students who need help and those who don't, while at the same time minimizing those false positives and false negatives. If you have to live with one or the other, the false negatives are easily to deal with, because what you're in essence is saying is we thought this child needed help, but they really don't. They needed extra help, but they really don't. At least we get a chance to work with those guys, and then we can put them back into tier two. The ones that that drive us nuts are the unhappy surprises. Those are our happy surprises that I called before, are our unhappy surprises, and those are the children who we likely missed. And that we said they really needed help, but for whatever reason, our screener missed them, and they languish along till finally some point in time they become so needy that we finally say, oh, they hit our radar screen. And unfortunately, as I noted last week, based on Connie Jewell's work, unfortunately, once we get to those guys, it can be too late. Okay, so we want to choose, make sure that our screening assessments do these four things for us. And then lastly is generalizability. That means that our screening instruments are able to work with a wide variety of children across different situations, and most of them will have those properties now. You should know this is the way that we evaluated ones. We don't expect you to do that work. If you go up to www.RTI4Success or the more recent tool chart, it's www.intensiveintervention.org, and if you go under the tools, You'll see if you hit that link, you can look at our tool chart, and you'll see basically is that this is the kind of work that the center does for you. And this is just a snapshot, but you can see then if you're in the process of choosing instruments, which ones have this is the classification accuracy, generalizability, the reliability, validity. And we kind of use this consumer-based or consumer reports-based approach to evaluating instruments. So you can go up there and see all the ones that we've evaluated, that vendors have sent to us to be evaluated, and what the relative merits are with respect to the psychometric properties, and make a choice based on your local situation. So that's a good thing. A lot of that work has been cut out for you and be able to make good decisions. Once you have those, then we once we've established those properties, then we can use those screening measures to do the kinds of things that we want. And as I said earlier on, is to get raw scores that we can interpret for students over time, get aggregate scores that we can look at collectively over time to make some determinations about response to tier one and the like. I know I'm coming up near my time here, so we just have a couple more slides. But here are a couple examples that I wanted to show you, too, of ways to do that. So here's a case, and this is not an uncommon one we see, about once we get our aggregate data back and we see our color-coded charts, and most of them use this configuration, as I said now, green and yellow and red, that here appears that we have a lot more yellow than what we might expect to see. If we go back to the original triangle, it was about 15%, right? We can see that the core curriculum is meeting the needs of about half of the students here. We have about what we'd expect with students in special ed or in need of really intensive intervention with about 10%. It's not too much, bit larger. What appears to be really kind of blown out of proportion here is yellow. Okay, and I usually, when I'm with an audience, ask for suggestions here, although I know that would be more difficult. You could type them all in here, but I know we're bumping up against time. So that one working hypothesis I would have here is that while the general education or the core curriculum appears to be meeting the learning needs of about half the students, there's a good deal of students who appear to need more than that, okay? So before I thought about bringing all these students into Tier 2, which if you have those kind of resources, you certainly could do, but I might start to think about maybe we need to augment the core curriculum in ways by bringing in more, augment it so that we make some decreases in that yellow. So if I was a curriculum director or a SPED director, I might say, well, let's get another benchmark or two or three. We'll continue on with our Tier 2, our RTI model, maybe only take those students who are most yellow of yellow or going towards the red side and start to bring them into Tier 2. But let's start to bring in additional things into the core curriculum that we might and see if that has some effect. So certainly I've seen districts that by way of course have foundations as part of their core curriculum, or I mentioned last week, and Scott Forsman might have sidewalks brought into the core curriculum. So what it means here is that we need to think about the core curriculum, or at least one hypothesis is the core curriculum, and how can we strengthen that to meet the needs of more students. Notice I'm not saying change the core curriculum, although that might be a case after you saw a repeated pattern of this over time. But what I'm saying is probably keep what you have. It seems to be working for some folks, and supplement it with something else. And as I noted, a lot of vendors now are developing those supplemental pieces to the core curriculum, which is a nice thing. Here's another configuration. Again, we see probably only about 50% meeting the learning needs of the general ed, or most of the students. We see the 20% in yellow down, you know, to more typical levels. What we see high, you know, really big here now is that 30%, right? And this is something oftentimes that our districts that we're asked to come in and consult with or work with, we see these kind of patterns early on. And again, there's probably a number of different working hypotheses here again. It might be one hypothesis, this might be a mismatch of the core curriculum to the learning needs of the group at large. That kind of is the example I provided earlier on. Maybe these are students in this district have a number of risk factors that are cumulative, and that the core curriculum doesn't meet those needs of those students. It might be another working hypothesis might be, if I saw this repeated over years, and it might be the case that I would start maybe have some questions about what's going on in Tier 2, right? Are the interventions that were choosing in tier two? Are they effective, or are they leading to a number of students moving through tier two quite quickly and going right into tier three? Recall early on that I said that a number of the I've been involved in a number of larger scale evaluation projects, and we typically expect about 3 out of 4 students to be responding positively to tier two intervention, meaning that we've got a good intervention or interventions or package of interventions. So it might be the tier two intervention here that might be weaker, leading to a lot of children going into tier three. The other hypothesis I would have here too as well is, what are our assessments? How are we assessing these children? And perhaps our assessments are leading to over-identification of students in tier three. So I'd want to, or not the assessments, or what is the RTI or the teaming process? Again, are we just moving students through the tiers as a matter of course, or we're really delivering interventions with good fidelity and integrity? So we have a number of different working hypotheses here. Again, core curriculum, tier two intervention, or maybe even assessment. And then lastly, this is the one that superintendents will take the credit for, is that we have a lot of students responding really well to the core curriculum, fewer students in the yellow and red. This is really kind of a paint your blue sky thing, but this is not uncommon. This would not be not uncommon for a district that does quite well on standardized assessment. And if you were to use the kind of, as the aggregated national norms or benchmarks, you would see a profile like this. Okay, you would see a profile like that, could potentially see a profile like this. And if you use your more local norms, you would probably want to see a profile that was more like the triangle that we showed a number of slides back, where it was 80%, 15, and 5. So screening assessments then can do a number of things for us. They can provide different data patterns for us when aggregated across students within either a grade or a school. And we can look at different patterns like the ones that we see here. A lot of programs now allow us to disaggregate the data by school and then maybe by grade and class if we'd like to do that as well. The second thing that the benchmark screening allows us to do, which we'll talk more about next week, so this would be at a group level, or sometimes we call a relative level, right? The second thing, and importantly, is that what they enable us to do in an RTI model to determine responsiveness is that they allow us to gauge or assess individual growth of a student individually from one point to the next. And we'll see how that we use two pieces of information next week in progress monitoring. We use the weekly rate of growth in response to the intervention as one piece of data, the slope, to gauge responsiveness. And then we also use an individual's growth with respect to benchmark assessment over time is the second piece of information. So I think I mentioned last week is that what we can have then is a profile of a student who's responding quite nicely to the intervention as evidenced by their slope or their rate of growth over time, their weekly progress monitoring. But it still is below the benchmark assessment if we use the 25th percentile, they're still below the 25th percentile. And what that's telling us is that the intervention's working well, keep on doing it, steer the course, and that with time, with more time, that we should see a student slowly close that gap. So in summary, in tier one, screening is primarily used for two things. It's used to get an aggregate assessment for, or let me say the big picture items here without reading verbatim here, are we should choose, make sure that we choose benchmark assessments that have known psychometric properties. Secondly, it really helps if the benchmark assessment is tied to a progress monitoring system, because when we start to make determinations about intervention effectiveness, it helps to compare apples and apples versus our apples and oranges. Third is that the benchmarks that we choose, or whatever those numbers are, we typically have some latitude with those, and we probably need to give some thought to our local profile, what's the profile of our district, right, and choosing those, okay? Have someone who knows, for example, an Ames Webb or Dibbles, who knows something about the local profile and chooses the correct benchmarks in there, or either overrides the system and puts your own numbers in. And then thirdly, is that benchmark assessment or screening assessment is really used for two reasons. One is to provide an aggregate snapshot of our student body at large over time. And then secondly is to be able to track the progress of an individual student from one time frame to another. So I'm going to stop there. I see there's at least someone's typing. I don't know if it's a question or not, but I'll take some questions. I know it's a little bit past the hour here, but I'll take some questions if people would like. Give some time for people to do that. I don't know, whoever's typing for one's coming in. So it's either a dissertation or hate mail. Let me see what's at some point in time something will pop up. Don't forget too, is I think that there's an evaluation that Molly had mentioned before. I see Teresa has logged on too as well. I want to say again, thank you for inviting me to come talk a bit a little bit more again. As I mentioned last week, I did some training for your RTI TAC, your Technical Assistance Center some years ago and had a lot of fun doing that. So here, do you have any suggestions for what to do? Students have been in Tier 2 now since September and there's no room in Tier 3 for them. Because as it's built on the suggestion I think probably if there's demonstrated need, if just a student or two or three, again, it's all going to be relative. If you can accommodate their Tier 3 needs within those folks who are providing Tier 2 intervention, assuming that there are some number of folks who are doing that, and if you can accommodate them within those resources, do so. If there are a number of students, I mean, if there are a growing number of students, then I think you need to, you probably need to approach the administration and talk about deploying more resources toward that Tier 3 intervention. If there are growing numbers, as I said before, I guess I'm playing generalities now, about one out of four students that we've worked with go from Tier 2 to Tier 3. I'm just playing against kind of the averages. So there are fewer in number. So generally, if we have 15% of our students to 20% of our students in the classroom, that's usually 1.5 to 2 students per class. If we have 4 classes in a grade, it's about 8 to 10, 15 maybe top students that we're going to see in a grade, depending on the size of your school again here. We might expect maybe 4 or 5 of those students to be Tier 3 then, or move into Tier 3, okay? So I don't know if you mean room like physically, can you, or is it room in terms of resources? So I don't know if I've answered your question there, but Teresa writes, can you share some examples of decision rules schools use to determine at risk? I think would be instructive. Yeah, I think I did this, but I'll go over them again. So some schools can use whatever the system provides as the defaults, and they. As I noted, in Ames Web will be either you have a choice on there, either using a local or a national norm. What I would recommend in the absence of that, if someone said, well, I don't know, we just need to pick something, I would probably choose the 25th percentile that corresponds to the national norm. Okay, because as I walked through the example before, is that you will definitely, in my experience, have enough students to work with in Tier 2, right? Even if your profile, your local profile, is exactly that of the national profile, you would expect 25% of your students, right? And those students who really don't need help, you should probably be able to figure them out relatively quickly, either by brief progress monitoring, or once they get intervention, they will respond so quickly that they'll find themselves back in Tier 2. Some other folks use the 16th percentile. Again, the danger here is missing the false negatives, missing those children who you think are not a problem, but they really are. But I think probably using the 25th percentile probably provides you with that comfort area. I was going to say just something, lost my train of thought. And then the third, as I said, is if over time you know how many students, and this kind of goes back to Patricia's earlier question, if you know that your resources are finite, then you can work the numbers so that you can anticipate how many students will be in those tiers ahead of time, and then set the cut scores accordingly using that method as well. That that takes a little bit more sophistication, but it can be done. Last week we also talked about, someone had asked about what if you're using multiple screeners, and that's a situation where it's just somewhat typical. People oftentimes use any running records or some other types of information, or Pontus and Pinnell or whatever you have you, in addition to kind of the ones that have come out of curriculum-based measurement framework. If you're going to do that, I think probably what I would suggest, if you have someone on staff, is to try to come up with a composite score that uses the all the indicators that you have. Otherwise, what I think happens in practice is that people, depending if they want to make a case that a student needs tier two intervention, will kind of cherry pick the scores that are lower on the different interventions or the different assessments, or if they want to, on the converse, try to limit the number of students, or for whatever reason need to limit the number of students, will pick the scores that are higher. But basically, by and large, people either use the percentile ranks or the ones that are given to us by AIMSWeb. I know what I was going to say. It's just to remind people again, too, is that depending on which ones you choose, will have some effects on what your tier two, what your tier two students look like. Any other questions? Or other questions, shall I say? We have another one coming in. How instructional instructional consultation fit in with our framework? This is a good question. It's one we talked about briefly last week too, as well. You'll notice in tier two, what I've talked about is that there's not much instructional consultation that goes on at all, much at all. Students who are identified or yellow come into they go into our kind of one size fits all approach. And the reason why we've done that, and then I'll say, those students who then move into tier three, that's where our problem solving or instructional consultation kicks in. And the reason why we've come to this, as I noted last week, is that what we found is that in tier two, the process that we go through is called problem solving, and the end goal of that approach, that model or approach, should be a more individualized intervention for every student who's discussed in tier two. What we found is that there is not a lot of individualization that goes on, and that by and large, most of the interventions, there's probably a couple, two or three, that are recommended for all students. So if that's the case, and given that time is so precious during our school day, we can cut down on the amount of meeting time that we have to do after our screening assessments, and just automatically get folks in the tier two intervention. I referred to it last week, those tier two guys, as the runny nose, coughs, and sneezes of intervention, meaning that they're very, very common. Oftentimes the problems that are presented are very, very common, and they're ones that can be dealt with very common and one-size-fits-all approach interventions. Once we use the consultation models, when students go into tier three, and that's where we sit down, oftentimes bring in some more diagnostic assessment then as well. Bear in mind that the students in tier three have typically come through the tier one and tier two. We have some information on them. They aren't students now who are responding to the more standardized approaches. Last week, I even think I called the tier two kind of like an educational amoxicillin. It seems to clear everything up. And then that's where we oftentimes bring in more diagnostic assessment. And in the area of reading, we have a number of different kind of tools and things. Actually, one of the things that we use is from, I think, the fourth speaker in the series. We use a number of her tools that she's recommended. And then we design an intervention through an instructional consultation model that is more individually tailored to that student in tier three. And as I noted last week, oftentimes that intervention or instructional intervention looks a lot like something that you might see in a special education classroom. When I said that, then I was quick to also follow up, is that it's not meaning that the child needs special education yet. Okay, it's important to note here is that special education doesn't own any particular instructional techniques. There's no class action suit that's ever said if you need direct instruction, then you can only get that in special education. So oftentimes kinds of things that we derive in Tier 3 are based on that model. Tier 3, as we also noted in the example last week, sometimes is kind of like a trial of a responsiveness to what special education might look like. Some children respond, as we talked about last week, is more oftentimes we see that in math, and they respond quite nicely to Tier 3 interventions. They're smaller in group typically, and now that they're more individually tailored, and then we get them back into Tier 2 and Tier, and then subsequently Tier 1. In the area of literacy or reading, oftentimes what we will see is that those students respond appropriately or in a manner or nicely to the Tier 3 intervention or the instructional consultation approach. But then when we start to pull that out, they start to fall back again. So it starts to give us insight into maybe that we need to then look for an eligibility determination to legally protect the child's access to that those kind of specialized forms of instruction under the auspices of special education. As I said last week, it's a different way of thinking about special education, but in an RTI model, you can stop intervention anytime you want, really. There's no kind of rules against it, but at least in that, when we start and we see a child responding real nicely, and then we see some pullback when the intervention is starting to be faded, that's usually a hint to us that we might want to move to that next level and protect their access to those kinds of things. Any other questions? That's a good question. I want to say that our screening, when we get our data from our screening assessments, they're relatively quick. We usually do them by grade level. Doesn't take much time. We put the data up shoot it through an InFocus projector, and we look at it very, very quickly and kind of make our decisions from there. For those who are Ames Web users, there's one report that I really like. It's not one you can only get it at the individual classroom level, and we can do that by classroom because it basically, what is it, color codes starting from the bottom up, and basically we can start to make the decisions at each class level about and the nice thing about the report is that I'm skipping a point, it provides a child's name and their score, and then it also provides what the instructional recommendation would be for them if you used a local versus a national norm. So what you can see then is that the influence that the two norm groups play on each other. All right, so yeah, there's not much instructional consultation goes on there. 20 minutes to a half an hour, we have our groupings kind of figured out, and off we go. We can get going then. If we do them on Friday, we can get going with them on Monday. Any other questions? I don't see any typing going on, so I'm gonna probably stop now. I want to thank folks who came in first, logged on today. Oh, we got some. Oh, Molly's typing. Okay. Oh, we got one of the people. Let me see. I think Anastasios is typing again. So we'll take this one, and then. But while she's while they're typing, I want to thank again folks for coming on today, staying after school. Oh, just thank you very much. Fantastic. Well, thank you very much too. So anyone from Lakeland School District here today? I shouted out last week. That's where I went to school. So down in Peekskill, New York. I want to thank Teresa and the TAC, and I will be back again next week at the same time, and we'll take this assessment, we'll just be taking this one step farther and talking about progress monitoring, how we can set goals in the progress monitoring system, and then importantly is how we can use now the benchmark or screening assessment data and progress monitoring assessment data together to determine responsiveness to intervention. All right? So thank you very much, and I hope to see some of you back again next week. Okay? Bye-bye. And Molly, I'll hang on if you want to drag me into the sub room or something, if there's any housekeeping that we need to take care of.